On February 1st, 1997, in West Memphis, Arkansas, a young man named Charles Newsom was fatally shot in his car. According to some witnesses, Charles was with two others in his car, but only one was ever identified: Frederick Tyrone Ellis. Ellis gave inconsistent accounts about the number, location, and identities of the assailants, eventually fixing the narrative on first four and then three men from a rival neighborhood: Antonio Williams, DeMarco Wilson, and Kendrick Gillum, who he placed outside the vehicle for the shooting. However, the ballistics and physical evidence say something different. This is Wrongful Conviction. You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we're going to return to West Memphis, Arkansas. Yes, the home of the West Memphis Three, one of whom, Jason Baldwin, first told our colleague Maggie Freeling about the case we're going to be covering today. And we're going to link that episode of Unjust and Unsolved in the episode description. And this case involves the same local legal system, as well as three co-defendants, one of whom, Kendrick Gillum, is calling in from an Arkansas prison. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Now, a second former guest, Marty Tankleff, well, it was his efforts through the Making an Exoneree class at Georgetown University with Professor Mark Howard that led a group of students to reinvestigate the case for Ken. And we're joined by one of those former students who is currently seeking her master's in investigative journalism. Claudia Mendoeda, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Ken's life, growing up in this small and notorious city of only about 25,000 people on the west side of the Mississippi River from Memphis, Tennessee, called West Memphis.
My mom, she had me July 24th, 1971. You know, I had a pretty normal childhood. You know, my mom, she took good care of me and my brothers. We come from a big family, and all of us was close in that neighborhood because I said, like, from 5 years old, we would always get together on the weekends. Or in the summer when school was out, we was always somewhere on the bikes together, playing football, basketball, collecting cans and cutting yards together. We had little lawn service business we had, you know, to get extra money in our pockets. And, you know, we all just grew up together. You know, we were basically always there for each other.
This group of family and friends lived in the Foxwood area of West Memphis, and there was a rival neighborhood group from about a mile and a half away on 18th Street, and Foxwood continued to stick together as the kids became teens, and as problems became more complicated as they were introduced to the drug trade.
I said father started, I said about ninth grade, you know, we started hanging out, chasing girls, drinking beer, not doing what my mom said. And then like 16, I was really like, I was just full-fledged running the streets. And I had a partner that I used to run with, and he'd be selling drugs all night. And I'd just be running around with him. And I was like 17 when I first got shot.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, I was like 17 when I first got shot. So I've been shot three other times. The first, it went through my esophagus, and it came out my shoulders. Then I was shot in the stomach, and it came out my back. Another time I was shot in the leg and the upper part, almost by my balls. And the last time, the detectives watched the 18th Street dudes shoot up where I was at. They came through three cars deep, and he watched them shoot at us. And then he pulled up and shot me, and he shot my homeboy two more times, which added to the 11 times that he was already shot.
Detective Brian Ridge, who's also a big character in the West Memphis 3, shot his friend. His friend is kind of on the side of the road. Ken is trying to take him to the hospital, and then he shoots Ken, so he can't help him.
Well, I'm laying on the floor bleeding, and the police got a gun to my head. Ridge got a gun to my head. They start shooting up my mama's house. I could hear it around the corner. He watched three cars with SKs shoot up this house, and he didn't pursue them.
It seems like Detective Brian Ridge and potentially others were at the very least turning a blind eye to the 18th Street guys.
I didn't get any evidence to this, but it was something that everyone told me when I was in West Memphis. Like, the people in the 18th Street group were working with the police to sell drugs. one woman sat down with me and she was like, how do you think drugs get into West Memphis? Like, we don't have a port. Police will do a drug bust. And you think they're throwing those drugs away? They're not. They're putting them right back in circulation.
The girl I was going with, I had the kids by. They pulled up on her brother over at the gas station one day. And he was saying that they pulled up on him and said, hey, you need to go talk to Kendrick. We got something for you. And y'all ain't got to worry about us sweating y'all. As long as y'all keep it down over there, y'all ain't got to worry about us arresting nobody. But if you don't, we'll be to see you. So what happened was he came and told me, and I refused to sell dope for him.
And it appears that perhaps one of the more prominent 18th Street guys, Terrence Robinson, may have taken this deal, while Foxwood suffered the consequences.
The girl I was going with, her brother, they gave him an indictment. They got my brother on the indictment. They got Chuck, Kirkwood, Lil E. They got my whole neighborhood on the indictment. The only one probably was left that didn't get an indictment was me, almost.
So Terrence Robinson, he's the person who, like we said, sold drugs with the police. He had a cousin called Daryl Robertson. Daryl gets shot, and that's what they try to put on Ken. But that fails.
They found out that the girl that he got to go write that statement on me was lying. And guess who had to drop the charge? The one was investigating. The same one that shot me. Brian Ridge.
And with the context of this unholy alliance between the police and Foxwood rivals on 18th Street, tensions flared further over a dice game in 1996 involving Ken's friend Chuck and Terrence Robinson, who was with James Newsom, the cousin of the victim in this case.
My homeboy Chuck was in the neighborhood. They had a dice game going on in the neighborhood. James Newsom and Terrence Robinson started shooting dice with him. Anyway, Chuck had beat Terrence out of his money. So Chuck took off the walking. They pulled up. Terrence got out the car and hit Chuck in the face and tried to go in his pockets and take his money. So that's when the fight started. And after that, we ended up seeing them at the skating ring. We was going to the back, and they was coming away from the back. And we all got to fight there. And that's when the first shots were fired there.
And this kicked off a series of incidents of retaliatory gun violence leading up to the incident in question on February 1st, 1997, which occurred at 900 West Macaulay Drive, the Mayfair apartment complex, which unfortunately was no stranger to gunfights. And with this ongoing feud between 18th Street and Foxwood, the likely assumption was that someone from Foxwood was involved in the shooting. Now, the victim in this case, Charles Newsom, lived there with his parents. And according to some witnesses, Charles left home with Terrence Robinson and Frederick Tyrone Ellis.
Tyrone Ellis said that he was over Charles Newsom's house in Mayfair apartment, waiting on Charles to take a shower, take a bath, and they was on their way to Memphis. They walked out to the car, and they drove past by the manager's office, and he said that he seen four people out there, and they began shooting inside the car.
No one is very certain about how many shots were fired or when the shot hit, but there was basically a shootout happening. Someone took their hand out of the window, started shooting back.
Ellis said that Charles made a right on McArley and wrecked and hit another car. And he said Charles said he couldn't breathe. And so Tyrone said that he scooted over and stuck his leg under the gas pedal, and he drove from the passenger side all the way back around to the front of the building where he went and got help.
So the cops arrived, and according to some witnesses, Terrence Robinson should have been with Ellis to give an account, but no account has ever been found. Now, initially, Ellis had said that three or four black males who he couldn't identify were shooting from the passenger side, and that when Charles was hit, he reached his foot over to hit the gas to try to flee. But according to a document that was just recently found, the body was discovered in a position that really doesn't match his story.
We've gotten various accounts of how the body was found, but never this one, that Charles Newsom was basically turned back, and he was lunged over the driver's seat.
One witness, she said that somebody opened the door and looked at his car. It was cussing, and he jumped back in the car and drove around the building.
Which makes you think that whoever drove the car out of there made room for himself by pushing Charles over the seat, or perhaps Charles had even lunged back there since the shot may well have come from inside the car. But unfortunately, the state of the physical evidence hasn't made anything clearer. It appears, in fact, that Charles Newsom's car had been involved in previous shootouts. And plenty of damage to the outside of the car. Two bullets were pulled from the car ceiling that aren't part of the record in this case, as well as two bullet holes that police claimed had penetrated the interior and were related to this particular shooting. Now, how did they know that? We don't know. We have no idea. But maybe they said that because Charles Newsom was only shot twice, once in the right forearm and once in the right upper back.
They said only two bullet holes went to the interior of the car. The one that hit him in the forearm, it was said to have come through the back window, the very top of the back window. They supposedly had one that went through the trunk. They saying that a bullet went through the trunk, went through the back seat, the back of the driver's seat, hit him in the right upper side of his back.
But a picture of the open trunk showed no damage at all to the car stereo speakers that covered the seat backs. So the prosecutor actually motioned to have that photo barred from evidence. I'm just going to pause there for a second. Which, you know, my spidey senses are telling me that an independent investigation of the vehicle would have been prudent and necessary.
So the car gets sold immediately.
They released the car to his mama, and I guess that she got rid of it because her son got killed in it. The dude that bought that car, he said there was no bullet hole in the back of the driver's seat.
This is complicated, but I spoke to someone who spoke to the guy who bought the car, and he says there were no back seats.
So no driver's seat bullet hole, no back seats to even confirm or deny the alleged trunk bullet path. Somebody had gotten rid of them. Right? But the state's theory becomes even more unbelievable when you consider the bullet's trajectory through Charles Newsom's body.
They saying that a bullet went through the trunk, went through the back seat, went through the back of the driver's seat, hit him in the right upper side of his back, and terminated in the lower left front.
It's a downward trajectory.
That bullet wouldn't have hit him and took no downward path. That bullet would have went straight through a person.
In my eyes, the fatal shot has to have come from inside the car. Based on the ballistics, there is no other way it could have happened. Absolutely no other way.
The ongoing inter-neighborhood gun violence had both the police and alleged witnesses speculating about Foxwood, specifically about Ken Gillum and Antonio Williams, which wasn't that wild of an idea considering Ken's alibi, because Ken was at his girlfriend Tarshella Flores' home with his two kids, one of whom was nicknamed Pooh, and sometime before the shooting took place, some Foxwood guys had stopped by.
So Ken's girlfriend, her two brothers are these big drug dealers in West Memphis, the LaFlores. So that house was kind of where they all hung out. That's where they sold drugs from. It was kind of like the meeting point. So that's why these people came over.
Some of my partners, they were like, come roll with us over here. We're going to get Charles. He's over in Mayfair. So anyway, Tasha, she was like, no. She called, Pooh, you better come get your daddy. Stupid ass trying to go back to jail. So he running there. Grabbed my leg, holding on to my leg. I was like, man, look, man, I'm straight. I ain't gone. I'm straight. So anyway, Charles get killed. My partner called me. He was like, hey, man, Charles, they got shot, man. Your name, the first name come up. He said, you might want to get your keys and stuff out the house. I'm hearing there's going to be some shooting.
So you might be thinking, wait a minute, does Ken actually know who did it?
See, the funny part is, they didn't do it.
Now remember, the bullet trajectory supports that the fatal shot had to have come from inside the car. And soon after the shooting, the police had more support for a close-range gunshot. According to a report summarizing the Arkansas Crime Lab's gunshot residue analysis that was entered into evidence at trial, Charles Newsom's jacket had, quote, one perforating hole in the upper right back with residues relating to a firearm discharge, end quote. But despite that, the state continued to build this sort of wild narrative about shooters outside the car, which centered and relied on Ellis's statements.
Now, the first statement, Tyrone Ellis said that, "I don't know who did it." That's the first statement. The second statement was gave a couple of hours after that. And he said that Gilman Williams did it. 5 days later, he gave a third statement saying four people did it. Gilman, Wilson, Williams, and Jackson. But Ronald Jackson was found out to be in Kentucky. So they know that was another lie.
So the mention of Ronald Jackson was just ignored, while the focus remained on the other three. And it seems DeMarco Wilson, who happens to be Ken's cousin, by the way, was seen at Mayfair that night by a man named Mark Welch.
Oh my God. DeMarco is like, that's a whole other thing. Like, he's not even in this friend group. He was in his girlfriend's apartment because they had a newborn child, and he just walked down because he heard shots. So Mark Welch, how he plays into the story, he just goes like, "I was there, I was in the apartment, and I saw DeMarco standing outside. He looked agitated." So that's how DeMarco comes into the whole thing.
So DeMarco's name was added to Ellis's third statement, and they picked up Ken a few days later, but he wasn't charged yet.
Well, they end up taking me down to the jail and keeping me overnight. And so that morning they got up, they took me to Jonesboro to take a lie detector test. So the man said, "I asked you, was you there?" You said, "No." "You passed it." "I asked you, did you have anything to do with it?" You said, "No." "You passed it." "I asked you, do you know anything about it?" And you said, "No." And that told you, sir, you were lying. So I said, "You saying I passed on not being there, and I passed not having anything to do with it, right?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, all right then. I'm innocent, so they can leave me the fuck alone, because I ain't did shit." And he said, "But they're showing that you're showing deception about knowing something about it." I said, "That ain't my job. I don't work for the police."
You don't want to mess with these people. So he was not going to start pointing fingers and get potentially retaliation from someone.
He ended up letting me go.
Since Ken was not going to give them any information, especially since he hadn't actually seen anything, they continued to build the narrative. In his third statement, Ellis mentioned two alleged witnesses who he said were just happened to be driving by, Darnell Troop and Kevin Johnson. Troop gave a statement about having heard the shots, while Johnson said that he saw Antonio, DeMarco, and Ken by the manager's office, and that one of them had had a rifle.
It's funny to read their interrogation transcript because the police go, "You saw these people standing on West Macaulay, right?" Kevin Johnson goes, "Right." "And it sounded like a rifle, right?" "Yes, right." So the police is literally, the way they're framing their questions is with the information they need.
Ellis, Johnson, and Wilkes, three of the witnesses that they had, all three of them had their charges dismissed 10 years after our conviction.
These three witnesses got their charges dropped on February 2008, all of them. And all of them but one has now come forward and basically said, "I was lying and I was offered something to lie." Kevin Johnson said that he got drugs in exchange for that testimony. So they all have their charges dropped the same month, the same year, and some even the same day. You know, and for people who are not like super familiar with what this means, like this highly suggests they were cop informants because cops were holding these convictions over their heads until they didn't need them anymore.
This Ellis got caught in an abandoned house with $57,397, 2 kilos, and was, if I'm mistaken, it was 2 or 3 guns. He got 5 years on a C, which he probably had to do 10 months, and he could have got out on that.
So Ellis, for example, he testified in like 5 or 6 criminal cases, like a bunch of them, always saying whatever the police needed him to say.
And those weren't the only deals to be had. Ken was offered 10 years with just 2 years to the parole board. Now, call me crazy, but it sounds to me like they may not have really thought he did it if they're offering him 2 years for a crime this serious, but okay. But Ken refused the deal. What guilty guy refuses that deal? That's the best deal they're ever going to get. But Ken refused. So they bolstered their case with a jailhouse snitch named Jeff Caton. Now, fun fact, one of the investigators in West Memphis at the time, a guy named Mike Allen, well, he's the current sheriff of Crittenden County, and he's now married to Jeff's sister. Anyway, Jeff gave a statement saying that in jail, He's actually married to the jailhouse snitch's sister. Just when you think you've heard everything on Wrongful Conviction that you can hear, and then you hear stuff like this. Anyway, Jeff gave a statement saying that in jail, he'd overheard Ken just rambling on and on about the shooting.
Jeff Kane says that the prosecutor, Fred Thorne, came to him, and what they wanted him to say is that he heard me in jail saying that I killed somebody. And he signed the paper, and they said they wouldn't send him to the penitentiary. They sent him to boot camp, a 90-day program that they had, like a little army thing, and they get out. So they sent him to boot camp 2 weeks prior to our trial. We went to trial November the 4th through November the 7th, 1997. And on the stand, he said he didn't get a deal. And he said that he heard me say that I shot the guy's car up with a shotgun. And when no shotgun fell found, when no shotgun bullets found, no shotgun pellets, slugs, or anything pertaining to a shotgun was found.
You know, it's wild that with all of the shell casings from this incident and others at Mayfair, they still couldn't find one shotgun shell that would have made Caton's testimony make sense. And by the way, he later recanted his statement as well, in case this wasn't screwed up enough. Next up, Darnell Troop said he had heard the shots while he drove by with Kevin Johnson, who took the stand as well.
He said that him and Darnell Troop were in the car together, passing by, and he said, we shooting at Newsom's white car. With Newsom's car was purple. And he seen me, Williams, Wilson, and Jerry Johnson at the manager's office.
So Kevin Johnson, who later recanted, offered an entirely new person into the narrative. Just out of thin air, a guy named Jerry Johnson appears in this narrative, who also ended up having a solid alibi, like Ronald Jackson had had from Ellis's third statement.
Now, Ellis, his first two statements, they were withheld from us until the first day of trial. And they caught that man in so many lies. They said on your first statement, why didn't you just tell him who did it? Oh, man, oh, I just wasn't saying nothing then, you know what I'm saying? And I said, what about your second statement? You said Gilliam and Williams did it. Oh, man, I just gave him a little something. Come on, man. Do you remember saying you seen him out at the passenger's window? No, I ain't say that. So they played a video statement. Said, yeah, I seen him out the passenger's window. What kind of guns did she? Two of them had, like, rifle, AK-like guns, and one of them had a handgun. Do you remember saying that you seen they had chrome guns? No, I don't saw. So they played a video statement. Yeah, they had chrome guns. Then what about the fourth person? Oh, I just probably was mistaken about them. But so you for sure about these other three? Yeah, I'm for sure. So who had what guns? Oh, man, I couldn't tell. It was too dark.
For the record, it was 8 p.m. in February. The area wasn't well lit, so it probably was too dark for anyone to have seen what they claimed to have seen. But at this point, despite the inconsistencies and discrepancies, the jury heard three witnesses name the three co-defendants without any context of the deals they'd made with the prosecutor's office. And in addition, they were able to keep Ken's alibi witness, Tarshala Flores, off the stand.
They come in with two bullet clips that they said they found at Tasha's mother's house, just doing a drug raid 6 months after the murder. And they saying that these bullets had the same lot number on them as the one found at the scene. So she didn't testify for me because they were trying to act like I had something to do with it. How the hell did I have something to do with anything? I was in jail for 6 months when y'all raided their house. The lot number on the back of the bullets don't mean nothing. That's just the year that they was manufactured. And I can bet you this. If you had any other AK shootings or SK shooting shells found, you're going to have the same lot number because all the drug dealers went to the same place and bought the bullets, and that was Red Barn.
Again, this is important context that the jury never heard. Now, the prosecutors also called Detective Brian Ridge to discuss his magic curving bullet theory.
The same motherfucker that was involved in the West Memphis 3 trial and the one that shot me, Brian Ridge, did his own trajectory, showing that this is the path that he think the bullets took. And he came in with a homemade picture that he drew up. He took a box car, a juvenile picture that a five-year-old could have drew. And it had the direction that he think says that the bullet went. Five bullet holes hit the car. Only two bullet holes were supposedly penetrated the interior. The victim was hit in the right forearm. Now, this red bullet it was said to have come through the back of the window.
Which is plausible. The bullet could have struck his forearm as he held the steering wheel, or perhaps he raised his arm, you know, defensively at some point, and it was struck. But then the only other possible entry point that they claimed was through the trunk, which they said traveled through the back seat and driver's seat to hit Charles. And remember, we mentioned that the prosecutor already objected to admitting the picture of the open trunk into evidence.
They come into court with some photos showing a bullet hole of the car, right? So now they come to the bullet hole in the back of the driver's seat. Guess what? It can't be found. And the judge was like, well, they said, well, you had it this morning, didn't you? He said, yeah, I had it. But you seen it lost from the police station to court. But you can't show a hole in the back of the driver's seat.
This is now like the dog ate my homework. And then to make matters worse, the state's next witness, Kevin Mainhart, testified about the gun that was alleged to have been used in this case, an SK rifle, which was helpful with demonstrating that the bullet could have made it through all of those different objects, but not with the downward trajectory.
He testified about what a SK can do, and he said it will go straight through a whole motor. So how would it hit somebody and take a downward path? This ain't making sense.
So through their own witnesses, the state had just contradicted their own narrative, and they were about to do it again. While presenting the medical evidence, they entered a number of documents into evidence, including a report summarizing the Arkansas Crime Lab's gunshot residue analysis. Now, importantly, the gunshot residue of the victim's hands was not submitted, and we'll get to that in a minute. So at trial, one of the things this summary report said was that Newsom's hands tested negative for gunshot residue, and they put the medical examiner, Dr. Frank Peretti, on the stand.
Probably the most insane part of this trial is that they never get a ballistics expert to come testify. They get a medical examiner. And this was a doctor that infamously also testified in the West Memphis 3 trial. So he's testifying in Ken's case. And he says, basically, I don't have qualifications to do this. The judge says, it's okay, go on, go on. And what he says in trial is that there was no close range firing because he didn't see residue on the victim.
And he specifically mentions the victim's skin. And this is something he can speak to as an expert. There are ways to optically examine for residue, or there can be stippling, which is the burn pattern one can expect with close-range gunshots. But the victim was wearing three layers that night. Remember, it was February. A shirt, an undershirt, and a jacket. And the report from the Arkansas Crime Lab says that there is residue relating to firearm discharge around the hole in the right upper back.
But the medical examiner is literally saying the shot was coming from 15, 20 meters away, like the bullet came from outside the car. While there's information that there's primer residue on the victim, and this is pointed out by one of, it was either Antonio or DeMarco's lawyer, and they were like, look, this is impossible. There's an inconsistency. The state is saying that there's primer residue on the victim, and yet the medical examiner is saying that there's no evidence of close-range shooting. This is impossible. But a juror who's not an expert on ballistics doesn't understand that. I mean, I had to study this to understand it. If it was just said to me like this, I wouldn't understand it either.
And it seems that this case required at least a ballistics expert to further explain this to the jury. But that didn't happen before they went to deliberate.
I found out afterwards that my grandmother, she had went in the hall to the bathroom. And they had called a break. So the hallway, it leads out the judge's chamber. So he was going to talk to the prosecutors. And they said, he told the prosecutors, he said, hey, man, y'all case is fucked. Y'all need to do something.
Now, we've gotten a hold of one of those jurors, and he said, it's a long time ago, man. I don't remember, but he was very clear. He was like, when the jurors were deliberating, one of the prosecutors walks into the jury room, and they say something to the jurors that's tempering with their decision.
And then those jurors returned with their verdict. All three men were convicted of first-degree murder and given life sentences without the possibility of parole.
There's a lot of crying and a lot of disbelief. I was like, it was like, man, these motherfuckers took my life for some shit they ain't know what I'm gonna do. I said, it's fucked up, you know? It's a feeling you just can't explain because It'll make you feel so mad. You'll feel like fucking like Timothy McVeigh or some shit. You see what I'm saying? In the penitentiary, you have to sit here and wait and hope something change. Man, this fucking shit wrong, man. Now I gotta try to find a lawyer that'll take it. I need help. It's hard, man. It's just hard. You don't know the feeling. Man, I lost my brother. All my grandparents gone. I done even lost a grandchild since I've been here. My brother was murdered. My grandma died in the same man that helped put me here, preached at her funeral. What kind of shit is this? What kind of fucking shit is this?
One of the investigators on this case, Detective Vaughn, became a preacher. And as luck would have it, or fate, or whatever, irony, whatever you want to call this, when Ken was allowed to attend her funeral, who the fuck do you think he saw there?
He couldn't even look at me. The man, I was sitting on the front row, and every time he looked over there at me, he put his head down. He put his head down. I wanted to get up, but I had respect for my grandmama. I wanted to get up and say, man, y'all get this bitch up out this church, because this bitch lied on me and got me in here in this penitentiary. After they put my grandmama in the car, I walked up to him. I said, you lying, punk-ass bitch. And my mama was pulling me away from him. I cussed him out. Everybody was looking at me like I was like, they were looking at me. I was like, y'all, this bitch. This bitch wanna reason why I'm in here for some shit I ain't do. So they do this shit to you because they can do it. The only thing this shit is, it's criminals locking innocent motherfuckers up.
The three co-defendants had an alleged confession back in 1999, but that fell apart before it even went to an evidentiary hearing.
Vaughn had came down here and told him that if he sit there and took this charge, that they was gonna send him to death row. Vaughn came down and told dude that. That's why dude changed his testimony.
Following that, Kevin Johnson came forward in 2001, claiming that he was offered drugs by one of the victim's friends in exchange for this testimony. And the team went back to court in 2003.
Well, back in 2003, the issue was raised. It was the same thing that got the West Memphis 3 free, the same appeal that they used due to scientific testing.
So they filed a 1780, 6 years later. And the report comes back. Turns out there's primer residue in Newsom's hands.
In discovery, they received a hidden gunshot residue exam of Charles Newsom's hands that informed the Arkansas Crime Lab report summarizing their GSR analysis. And it appears to support that Charles Newsom hadn't fired a gun, but the primer residue on his hands implies that Charles was in close proximity to gunfire. And the criminalist who prepared the report testified about how this and the residue on the jacket could somehow mean that this was not a close-range gunshot.
He said, the reason I say it wasn't close-range shooting is because it was bullet wipe. She said, well, bullet wipe is it had the bullet pass through the barrel of the gun. It takes the smut from the inside of the barrel, and then it fragments, and then it goes through the powder burst, and it wipes off on what it touches.
But a quick Google search of bullet wipe tells us that it refers to the deposit made at the entrance point when a bullet strikes a surface. So in this case, according to the state's narrative, that would have been the trunk or the back window.
The only way that Newsom would have primer residue in his hands was that if the shot had come from close range.
Or that Charles was in close proximity to gunfire.
They denied it because they said that there was no new scientific testing that would have helped us. But in some of the cases I read, they saying that it is not just for mere reversal to be gained when a defendant is convicted knowingly on, or not knowingly on false evidence. And they know that they convicted me on false evidence.
And so did Jason Baldwin of the West Memphis 3, who knew DeMarco Wilson while he was in prison. Now, we'll have their stories linked in the episode description, so check them out. But upon his release in 2011, he eventually began a nonprofit to reinvestigate innocence claims. And this was their very first case. They tracked down witnesses and tried to access the old case evidence to test for DNA, fingerprints, to reconstruct the crime scene, anything. And DeMarco went back to court in 2018.
They was trying to find out where the evidence was at, the bullets and the jacket that he had on.
All of it is missing. And all of the reports are missing too. So not only don't we have the shirt, the jacket, and the car, any of that, which is already huge misconduct because you're meant to keep evidence from a murder case forever, we don't even have pictures of it. And when we bring Mike Allen to court and they're like, hey, what happened to this evidence? He's like, it says I checked it out, but it wasn't me. Someone else done it. Someone else must have written my name. I don't know where it is.
So someone just checked the evidence out in 1997 and it's just gone.
So, I mean, very convenient that because if we had that evidence, we could prove that Ken didn't do it. You could do all types of testing. You could test the powder again. You could test for DNA. You could test all types of things. But that didn't go with their story because their story was that the shooters were from outside the car. So there could have been no powder anywhere. And the evidence would have proven otherwise.
Jason's team made contact with another potential confessor around 2020 who had contacted law enforcement as early as 2017, who was finally saying something that aligned with the evidence. But that person took their own life before swearing under oath. Now, perhaps this wasn't even the right person, but it was a similar tale to the 1999 confessor that three individuals, potentially the same guys that had stopped by Ken's girlfriend, Tarsha's, earlier that night, had driven up next to Newsom's car and opened fire. And then the person in the backseat of Newsom's car pulled a gun to return fire, and they believe that's how Newsom was shot from close range. Maybe that's what Ken meant by they didn't do it. Meanwhile, after years of outreach, Ken had finally gotten a response from the Making Exoneree class at Georgetown.
First, we got the thing that came out 6 years later that had never been looked over by an expert or an attorney, the primer residue analysis. And then we finally sent it over to a ballistics expert and he was like, this is primer residue. Like that shot came from inside the car. That didn't come from outside the car. And then we also have, I got like, what, 500 pages worth of documents. And it is my understanding, I'm trying to reach out to Ken's original attorney, but I sent them to Ken and we talked and he was like, I don't have any of this. Like I never got any of this.
And they also looked up Jeff Caden.
He's been trying to come forward for a while because he's dying now of cirrhosis. And now he called us and he goes, I need to clear my consciousness. Like, I need to right this wrong. And he had years in prison. And he basically said, the officers told me a story. And they said, you tell that on the stand and you'll go to boot camp. You get off with a slap on the wrist. Like, you're good. So that's exactly what happened to him. Kevin Johnson, Jeff Caton have recanted and someone else, Paul Hunt, has come forward and said, I was Jeff's cellmate, and he confessed to me many times to falsely testifying in that trial. So that's corroborated. And then we have someone who has now come forward and said, the people who actually were shooting at Newsom drove the car to my house and confessed to me. Him and the three other guys confessed to her, and that was not Ken Gillum. And this woman had never spoken until I called her a few months ago because someone gave me her name.
So potentially there's a connection between Ken's story, this witness, and the three men from the other confessions. In the meantime, Claudia and the team, Tamaya Hayes and Brandon Teeham, well, they're not giving up.
We're in touch with a crime scene reconstruction expert and also a handwriting expert because we believe some of the signatures about medical reports and ballistics reports and all of that has been forged. From the beginning, the one thing Ken always said to me is, look at the ballistics. It doesn't make sense. It does not make sense. It could not have happened like that. So they were looking for the shirt, the jacket, and the car, any of that. So in the West Memphis Street trial, they also said it was all gone. And then it was actually all in the West Memphis Police Department. So when I was in Arkansas, I went there. Me and my two colleagues, we drove there and we asked for it. But you can only access that type of evidence if you're a lawyer.
So perhaps a lawyer or a crime scene reconstruction expert, anyone listening would like to offer their help. Anyone out there who would like to speak, it's never too late. And if so, we're going to leave ways that you can contact Claudia in the episode description, where you can also find the documentary that they made for Ken's case. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. And this is the part of the show that I always look forward to, where First of all, I thank you from the bottom of my heart on behalf of our whole team. And now I'm going to kick back in my chair with my headphones on, just close my eyes and listen to anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. So, Claudia, why don't you go first and then just hand the mic off to Ken?
Ken was guilty way before he ever stepped foot in that court. The police wanted a conviction and they went to many lengths until they got it. And there's just no way that physically the ballistics make sense. There is no way that shot came from outside of the car. And there is no testimony still holding that hasn't been recanted or proven to be coerced except the testimony of someone who has a personal stake in this case. Someone who gave various different testimonies that don't corroborate with each other. Ken has been in jail for 29 years, and 29 years later, there is the testimony of one person who's a cop informant, and that's what's keeping him in jail. And we just got to get him out. It's time. He hasn't seen his kids in nearly 30 years. He's 56 now. He hasn't had a life. He went to jail when he was in his 20s, and he's not guilty. And everyone knows he's not guilty. He's the victim of a town and a system that has never been held accountable for what they've done. And it's enough.
Well, like I said, it's just something needs to be did about this because they constantly getting away with it. I'm wondering why Arkansas doesn't have a CIU unit. You mean to tell me that people don't think that Arkansas has falsely convicted people? Come on, man. I only know maybe two people that have been cleared of it, or crimes they didn't commit. That's the only thing I've ever heard of. I know John Brown, and if I'm not mistaken, it was Rodney Bragg. Yeah, like I said, you know, I'm looking for an attorney to help with this case and take this case because I know Arkansas needs to be exposed to this. You know, they need to really be exposed.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.